Hello, listeners. Welcome to Season 7 of the Big Unlock podcast. My name is Ritu M. Oberoi, and I'm a managing partner here at Big Rio and Demo Consulting. And I'll be your host today for the Big Unlock podcast. And today we are absolutely thrilled to welcome Dr. Ami Bhatt to our podcast. Dr. Bhatt is a cardiologist, and she's the Chief Innovation Officer at the American College of Cardiology and Chair of the FDA Digital Health Advisory Committee, two roles which place her at the center of how healthcare institutions adopt, govern, and scale technology. Harvard and Yale-trained cardiologist, and formerly at Mass General, Dr. Bhatt has spent her career inside the systems that deliver care, which is precisely why she understands why and where they break. Her work spans AI governance, digital health strategy, and health equity, and we could not be more thrilled to have her here with us today. So welcome, Dr. Bhatt, to our podcast once again.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Would you like to add anything to that long introduction that I just said?
Oh, that was much too much already. That was just fine.
Great. So usually we like to ask our guests about an origin story, like how they got into, you know, medicine and healthcare and technology. And sometimes guests share really personal anecdotes and really interesting stories with us. So would you like to share something?
Yeah. So just like every other kind of first generation kid in the US, right? I liked science. I liked people. I went into medicine is what I always thought my story was. And it wasn't until I took the time to think a little bit deeper that I realized what I love about medicine. And it sometimes takes you some time to figure it out. And it's that I don't think in any other profession, you have the opportunity to be entered that deeply into somebody's life and feelings as in medicine when you first meet them, right? Within 15 minutes, you know everything about them, not just their health, but their family and what they want. And it's that connection that is so important to me. And so I think that has been the driving force of why I wanted to become, but also then remained a clinician for so many years, and really almost why it took me to here. So I practice adult congenital heart disease. So I had a young population, kids who grew up, once they turned 16 or 18, they came to me. And now those teenagers, 20, 30, 40, 50, that became my journey with them. And the most interesting part of that journey is they were living with lifelong disease. This was not just an episode. This was something where they always knew I would keep going back and hopefully I would have long periods of time in between. But coming to the hospital was not just a one-time thing. It was a reminder of a medicalized childhood, right? I had patients who said just the smell of the hospital made them feel nervous. And so I started doing telemedicine for my patients, really. Mm-hmm. Back about 7 years before COVID, I started my telemedicine practice. As you can imagine, at the time, not a lot of people were doing it. So people said, Dr. Bhatt, how are you going to take care of these complicated patients without touching them? And then I started looking into what are the digital technologies I need? Digital stethoscope, handheld ultrasound, image sharing. How can I teach my patients themselves to be empowered and understand what they needed to do? You know, I had a patient once up in Maine, and the doctor said, oh, well, there's something wrong with your heart, and that's why you passed out at softball. And he said, no, I tripped, and my heart always sounds like that. And he played the recording of his heart murmur. This was in 2014, because I had recorded it with one of the first digital stethoscopes. And I said, if anybody ever tells you that this is a problem, you tell them that. And so they really felt empowered by being able to stay at home, take their visits from there, have me and them together teach the local people in the community how to take care of them. And then they knew I was there for them when they needed me. And that model has carried with me to outpatient cardiology at Mass General, through COVID, and now to innovation and thinking about how do we empower the patient in the community with, you know, wearables, with other things, to be able to really follow and understand themselves, their own baseline. But when there is a trigger, when there is something that is changing, how do you then take that and say, okay, it is time to escalate to clinical care? And so that's kind of how I ended up where I am today.
Thank you, Dr. Bhatt, for sharing that story. That's amazing. I was reading about how you, you know, started doing telecardiology like 7 years before COVID, but that's so interesting that what led you to it. And you were truly a pioneer, because for the rest of us, COVID is what kind of normalized Zoom and just being remote, but you were doing it so much before. So that's an amazing story. And I'm sure the listeners would, you know, really like listening to that. So I was reading a little bit about, you know, all your LinkedIn articles and all your podcasts, and you've written that, you know, clinical acumen supersedes AI every time. And that's a really powerful statement in this era where AI models are becoming, you know, increasingly capable. So in your opinion, you've also said that clinicians are not short on intelligence or judgment. So how do you then build, you know, these healthcare systems that benefit from AI, but also ensure at the same time that clinicians don't lose these observational skills or intuition or pattern recognition that they've spent all these years, you know, studying?
That's right. So we are short on compute power. That's what humans are. Right? Humans are short on compute power because the amount of information available to us now far exceeds anything the human brain can utilize. Because we know that if you're sitting in front of me, not just your health records, your personal history, your family history, your personal preferences, your social determinants, your wearable data, your labs, any imaging that has come in, the research on the multiple diseases you may have by the time you're age 60, not you, but the average person, and what has happened since the guidelines that is even more novel research and may have made it to the guidelines, right? Because we're working on getting the guidelines out faster, but they're not immediate, right? How in 20 minutes can I do that? I cannot. I can be smart as I want. I can't do that. That is the role of AI. The role of AI is to surface knowledge, to surface information, and to use its compute to potentially see relationships and trends that would take us a very long time to figure out. Now, back in the day, there was less information and there was more time. There was one chapter about your disease. There was just the patient in front of you. There was no electronic health record. There was your own handwritten notes. And there was an hour to talk and ask the same question again and again and get a story. And we always used to say the most important thing is listen to the patient. The patient will tell you what's wrong. Well, nowadays, who has an hour to sit with your patient? It is unfortunate, but it is largely true. And we understand why colleagues go into concierge medicine, right? Why people are keeping smaller panels, because that is the magic of caring for patients. In its absence, we need compute power to be able to get to that point faster and then be able to use that information that we gathered and those insights that came to then say, does this fit this patient? Let me use my clinical acumen and decide what happens next from here. And that's the goal. And so I always tell my fellows, you have to, and I just said this last week, Cedars-Sinai has a great innovation program for existing physicians. I said, you have to use AI until your brain hurts. And in fact, there was a recent paper that just came out, I think I read it yesterday, that said the use of AI is not decreasing the amount of time knowledge workers spend. In fact, those in the knowledge industry spend more time now because of AI than before, asking questions, interacting, fixing an email's tone, doing something else. And so I think now the magic is we know we need to use it. Most of us have accepted it, right? We see the numbers, how many people are using ChatGPT, OpenAI, or the open evidence and other things. But I think now we have to understand when. When do we need to spend the time deep diving with it? When do we know what we're doing? And that is going to take time away from a discussion with a patient or something else, right? And we've not studied it yet. So at the American College of Cardiology, one of our goals right now is to have our own members using AI for a variety of things, largely question answer oriented, and say, how do they know when they're getting better? How can they know when they're being led astray? Or if they can't know, how can the computer tell and sense what's happening? And so I think there's a lot more study to be done. We are at the very beginning of understanding how humans and AI are going to interact in clinical medicine.
Whatever you said kind of really makes sense. And that this is the idea that, you know, appears repeatedly in your recent work, which is context. And you have argued that medicine is not just about recognizing patterns, but it's also about understanding the patient's experience, lived experience, and the clinician's accumulated experience. So as healthcare moves towards, you know, these increasingly autonomous AI systems, how do we ensure that this context becomes, you know, a design requirement rather than an afterthought? Like, how do we build it into these systems?
Yeah, you know, the first thing I was thinking about is when we start with the patient, right? The patient themselves is really not given the level of respect that they need in this equation right now. We're moving towards it. Because actually, rather than me figuring out what are the social determinants affecting you, why don't you directly bring that information to me? So how do we capture a patient's feelings, tendencies, preferences, styles, ways of engaging with healthcare? What is the best for an individual and how should they be engaged with? We need to ask that question up front. Don't ask that. We don't say, hey, we do say, hey, how does that doctor like their notes written or how does that? But we don't say, hey, how does that patient like to be engaged with? Now we do it a little bit. Would you like to do a televisit or not? Would you some of that? But there's so much more depth to that question. So I think that's number one is we have to start with the patient and engage the patient in study and help the patients understand how do I want to best engage with the system and express that and quantify that and then tell somebody that so that they can respond to it. So that's number one. Number two in agentic AI, and you know, that's why sometimes agentic AI is better because I can always tell my ChatGPT, nope, say it in an eighth grade level.
Yeah.
No, I don't like that tone, say it better. Mm-hmm. I can't say that to a doctor sitting across from me, like my colleague, right? And I might even feel a little awkward if the patient said, luckily I don't, because my patients used to do this all the time because they were, you know, age 20 or 30. And they'd say, I didn't understand that, Dr. Bach, can you draw it again? Or like, your drawing is not very good. Can we do something else? Right? And they would have a very honest conversation. And so I want that for the patient. And so agentic AI actually provides that maybe sometimes a little bit better than the clinician does who is rushed. Any clinician given time will do all of that. I am sure of it. We're just not given time. But the second is, if we're thinking about an agentic system, where does the clinician come in and place the guardrails? So two things. One I wrote about in my most recent Substack, which is there are certain places for each field. I wrote about my field in cardiology. There's certain places where we should not be allowing AI to make a decision without a human.
Yes, I read that.
Right? And we have to dictate what that is to the company or to the system that's implementing it and say, these are our hard stops where you need a clinician. You cannot do these things. But more important than that, as we're setting up the agentic AI, we should also be able to give our information back in specific to certain cases. And so I was actually just talking about a company this morning, UpDoc. It's a, you know, smaller company, but they are really trying to take clinician input as agentic AI is built and say, you set the guardrails. You tell us what you're comfortable with and not comfortable with. Now, this is even better than the entire system saying it. That's the individual doctor being able to have some say in the agent. That is a lot to manage. It's like a conductor having to do that. And so we don't know exactly how that'll work yet. But right now, I think those are the right kind of things to do, is study that ability to help agentic AI make the right decision at the right time and have the guardrails and have physicians feel in charge of it as much as we started by saying have patients feel in charge of their own process.
Great. Yes, I think that's a great answer. And I think, you know, you're also challenging the industry to think beyond, you know, whether AI can just generate the answer, and you're actually asking what happens after that answer reaches the patient. So as health systems are deploying more of these, you know, AI generated insights, do you think the next frontier is actually going to be communication? Like, how do you help these patients understand, trust, and act on these AI generated recommendations?
It is already communication. If you look at the wearable industry, the reason that the majority of individuals, regardless of socioeconomic status, educational level, place that they live in the globe, right, are increasingly wearing some form of a wearable, is that they want to be able to engage, learn data, find data. And the reason it works is not because the person really wants it only. It's because the systems that these apps create are by definition engaging. Yes. They know how to engage with the patient, how to make them feel empowered, right? And so that's already happening. And one of the things that I am focused on is how do we take that industry and have it be the roll in to clinical care and the roll out on the way out to catch people, right? Because we lose people everywhere in clinical care. And so it's really those technology companies' responsibilities to come with us on the journey and say, hey, I see a signal. Okay, we're going to provide some care. Okay, now they need hospital care. Oh, they're back out? Hey, you're back out. You're back in the system that caught you in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're trying to build.
So talking about these agentic systems, Dr. Bhatt, tell us a little bit more about this ARPA-H initiative, like the Advocate system, because they're using agents and agentic AI to do some of what you're describing, like constantly monitor and actually be able to intervene. So what are your thoughts on that program and, you know, what do you feel about that?
So Heather Warwick is a friend. He's a cardiologist here in Boston, heart failure doc. And so ARPA-H, for those who don't know, you can really apply with your own idea and say, hey, can I have funding to make this happen? And that's what he did. And the reason I like this approach is it is a pure research approach. The answer is you need to prove that you can have an agentic system that works, that can risk stratify, that says where a human in the loop is necessary, that can help monitor what happens as it's going along. And so the key problem we have right now in general is we have systems, we implement something, digital health AI, and then it's out there, right? And that's the reason that a lot of people are not implementing it is we don't know what will happen after, what will change. And the problem is we don't have an infrastructure for post-deployment monitoring. So what I'm almost most excited about, there is a lot to be excited about with Advocate, is we are going to have a number of examples of what post-deployment monitoring looks like, how we sense trends, how we sense shifts, how we decide to move those and change and iterate. And so I'm really excited for that. I think that's the key. The part we're missing is post-deployment monitoring. How do we keep track of it?
Yeah, Dr. Heather was on our podcast a couple of weeks ago and he was talking about ARPA-H and the moonshot and Advocate. So that was very interesting. So tell us a little bit more about your work at the FDA Digital Health Advisory Committee, because, you know, this is one thing that keeps coming up with our conversations with all the CMIOs and CIOs, that this thing is just moving too fast and the FDA, you know, regulations can't even keep up. And earlier they used to take years to like give you approval, but now by the time you get the approval, the underlying LLM has already changed and it's just a moving target. So tell us a little bit about your work there and how do you foresee closing this gap, because the technology is just advancing and moving at such a rapid pace.
So first of all, I have the utmost respect for my colleagues at the FDA who are there full time. You know, I am a special advisor to the FDA and I was the inaugural chair of the Digital Health Advisory Committee. And in the 2 years that we had initially started meeting, I think one thing became very clear is that there is a clear need to convene across patient groups, industry, technologists, and clinicians in order to better understand how the FDA can not regulate or deregulate. I think that's where we get stuck. When we ask that question, we get stuck. Mm-hmm. What we want to understand is from all of those people, how can we create an infrastructure for care that has guardrails, that includes the patient concerns, the technology company's needs, right? The clinician's workflow. And that's really that unsiloing, I think, is what's happening at the FDA right now, which is you will find them in every room, at every table, having conversations and maintaining that we need a high level of scientific rigor to be able to put an FDA stamp of approval on something, always. However, that FDA stamp of approval is the table stakes. That just means your technology works. Mm-hmm. And so what we're now thinking about writ large, and I'm not speaking for the FDA, but you know, all of us who are in this space now, is what comes next, not just the monitoring we talked about before, but how do we now think about, for example, a pre-control change plan? If I had a valve, but I have a new valve coming out, I get approved for this, but I tell you, I already know this one's in the pipeline. Problem is, I don't necessarily know what's in the pipeline with my AI just yet. How do we take real-world evidence and understand where are things going? How are things changing? What is happening next, right? And so I think that real-world evidence area is the next area that we've been talking about for a long time, but we really need to start capturing that data and understanding it better. And then the second thing I'll say is the FDA did allow some trend measurements and other things to start to happen in the cardiometabolic space that does not require FDA approval. And this came out earlier in this year. And I think the value of that is real world evidence we are getting now as to how quickly can you adapt from signals in the community saying sick or not sick, at your baseline or changing, and take those patients and put them into the clinical arena. And that's a very helpful mechanism, because then if you can bring them in, you understand why you brought them in. You have agentic systems to take care of the lowest risk, moderate risk. We're going to be in this middle ground for a while. High risk, yeah. Clearly need a human, right? Mm-hmm. Now we're going to really start seeing where that data is coming from, how it's helpful. But so I think the real world evidence is necessary, is what I've learned. Everybody's now at the table, including the FDA, which I love. But we've never had a time where change is the constant, right? It used to be like something, change, something. Now it's constant change, not just the technology, but the uptake. Not just the uptake, but the expectations of the clinical level. Not just the clinical expectations, but the patient demand. All of that is changing. And so all we can do is keep working together and look at real world evidence. Mm-hmm. And wherever we can find data, value it and study it.
Great. So I think maybe this will be the last question, because as usual, time has, you know, flown by. Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit more about this Elevate Leadership Program at Mass General, because this, you know, whatever you've been talking about, this rapid pace of change, this affects everybody. So clinicians really need to be, you know, up to speed with all these new technologies and everything. So are you all so busy with everything already? So how do you possibly find the time to, you know?
So about 4 years ago, we had a grateful patient family foundation that was willing to give us $3 million at the Mass General Hospital and fund a new style of leadership course. And so the course that I wrote with my colleague, Eitan Shapira, who was at MIT, was oriented towards leadership level individuals, only 15 in a cohort initially, where they were about to become leaders of large groups of individuals and clinicians. And the problem with healthcare for a long time is the better you do as a clinician and a researcher, the more likely you are to get an administrative managerial job. The skill sets do not necessarily overlap, mm-hmm. and they can, but they need to be taught. So there have been a lot of leadership programs for senior level people. But this time, the reason I wrote it this way with him is I saw the technology change coming because I was already in it for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So COVID was, you know, really the culmination of many of us in the digital health space. I was not alone, who for 10 years had been saying, this is necessary. High quality care in the community where people live. We need the system. Tech is coming. It is going to come faster. It is going to change. We're not ready to do that. And so in this course, we really work on how do you first just evaluate yourself as a leader, understand the discomfort that comes with change, mm-hmm. start to learn how to express and share that discomfort while still being seen as a leader, and be able to look now at what's coming and say, this is the unmet need that we need for our patients. Here are the technologies that might meet that. This is so interesting and very shiny, but not necessary right now. We will not look at that, right? And here are some things that aren't yet being built. So we as clinicians, who in general, academia stopped letting, you know, pharma in and, you know, don't come, don't give me the pens, don't do this. And we're kind of reversing now to say, yeah, let's talk about what technology you have. What can you do? Because if you don't hear from me for the technology that this is what I need and this is how it would fit, you're going to build something. And, you know, 86% of cardiovascular technologies passed by the FDA in this digital health realm and AI sit on the shelf. They do not get used. Yeah. So even passing the FDA does not mean you will be successful, right? No. And so that, the goal of this course, and it's been a lovely 3 years with just amazing individuals, and was this opportunity to create a community of people who lead in the same way, who lead not only with empathy, but who lead understanding discomfort is everywhere. It's not going away. It's because of constant change. Mm-hmm. And I am here with you, respecting that, understanding the challenges, and yet helping find the right next step each time to push us forward. And so that's the goal of Elevate. And thank you for asking. That was my last baby before I left MGH. So I really appreciate your asking about it.
Yeah. No, you're welcome. I think what you've said is, you know, absolutely so valuable, that change is inevitable and you really need to step up and face it and to actually prepare people to be, you know, to have that discomfort and tell them that you're not going to probably know everything, but if, as long as you keep learning, then you'd be able to face. That's right. And I think
that's right. And change is not in the future anymore. It's exactly what you said about the foundation model changing. If you run a practice right now, technology is coming at you out of a fire hose. Exactly. Every time. There will never be a point, if you are a leader in healthcare in the next decade, at least, where you'll say, oh, things feel pretty stable. They will always be bubbling, right? And you just have to decide, when am I doing things? How will I do things despite the constant change?
Exactly. So thank you, Dr. Bhatt. This has been a lovely conversation. Would you like to share any closing thoughts with our listeners and anything you'd like to share?
I think the most important conversations that happen are the willingness to put technology and clinicians and patients together and really think about what the systems should be. And so I would love for individuals to walk away thinking, wherever I work, however I'm involved, what is the infrastructure for care that is happening in my universe? And that's whether you're a venture capitalist or you're a clinician or you're a patient, right? What is the, do we have one? Do we have guardrails? And if not, who do I need to talk to put something in place? And we'll keep doing it from a national level, from the ACC, from the technology companies that I work with. But I think each individual, if they just take a moment and say, is there an infrastructure or is this so hard? Why is healthcare so hard? Because we don't have the right infrastructure anymore. Infrastructure was built in the 1970s, and that is not today's healthcare. And so I think that's, I would just say, look for infrastructure. It sounds boring, but it's everything. I think that would be what I would probably say. And if people want to reach out, I'm Dr. Ami Bhatt, DRAMIBHATT on LinkedIn, on Substack. And so I'm happy to chat with people and hear more ideas.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bhatt. Lovely talking to you. And I'm sure our listeners will learn a lot. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts today.
Thank you for having me.